Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. This week on the programme, my guest is the Medical Director of St Patrick's Mental Health Services Dublin and Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin, Professor Jim Lucy. Professor Lucy, welcome to The Leap of Faith.
Hello, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here. And we have a lot of things that we'd love to explore with you over the time we have with you. But I suppose we should start with the main reason we have you here on a Friday evening on The Leap of Faith is something that happened recently to you, becoming a lay canon. How did that happen?
It's an extraordinary thing. It came completely out of the blue. But the cathedral responded to a decision, I believe, taken by the Anglican community at a synod during the year to invite canons from an ecumenical perspective and a lay perspective into the cathedral and to make them part of the chapter. And it was a wonderfully generous act and one that I felt I had to respond to.
And you're in good company as well with Dr. Mary McAleese as well.
Very august company and to others. It's extraordinarily humbling and positive, I felt.
Out of curiosity, will it have any duties or obligations to you?
I think the roles of a canon, they probably go, they're written down somewhere in a medieval text somewhere in the past, but actually we're exploring the role and I think it'll be interesting to see what a lay canon can deliver in terms of perhaps contributing to the life of the cathedral. That's really what I'd hope would emerge, and the Archbishop Michael Jackson has encouraged us to meet and try and explore with the chapter how we can contribute.
That's also interesting that as we approach the anniversary of the Reformation, etc., that you, as a man born a Catholic, I'm
absolutely
assuming,
yes,
in this particular case, that would find yourself now involved with the with Christ Church.
Well, there's a whole series of anniversaries. You know, there's 500 years since the Reformation, 300 years since the birth of the founder of mental health services in Ireland, Jonathan Swift. And I have the privilege of working with a team who have that legacy now in St. Patrick's. And of course, the Anglican community has been well represented, as per Swift's dictate, on the board of St. Patrick's since its foundation 270 years ago. And so the Archbishop and the deans of the cathedrals sit in ex officio on the board. And that's where I came to know them and respect them. And really, I think that's it's out of the awareness of their continuing dedication to mental health and the legacy they have that they came to offer me this opportunity.
Are you aware of the history of St. Patrick's when you're there on a day-to-day basis?
You can't escape it. And in fact, we celebrate it. Because it's a giant you're dealing with, somebody whose footprint is so great, certainly on our side, but also whose sentiment about human justice, about the social justice of, and the needs of mental health is so resonant today, hundreds of years after he saw it. So he was a real visionary. He famously said, "Vision is the art of being able to see what no other can see." And that's real vision. And in his case, it was about the rights of human beings.
Now, when you were in, if you look at the history and the formation of psychiatry, for example, it would have come from a reasonably very scientific background rather than a religious background. How do you see that overlapping and how is that managed?
I mean, I think it's very important to recognise that mental health care is secular. And has always, in my experience, been very secular, not a religious motivated discipline, a scientific discipline in my own training, and something that is very much about the world and about human beings in the world. What's fascinating is, of course, Swift was a priest, he was a dean, and so one wonders what he thought about doctors. He famously thought that the best doctors in the land were Dr. Diet, Dr. Quiet and Dr. Merryman, an invention of holistic healthcare, again, centuries before his time.
Which is being taught at weekend courses all over Ireland.
Absolutely, and as though it was new, Michael, and it's not new, but it was extraordinary visionary of him to see that in fact healthcare and mental health care is about social justice and it's about holistic humanity.
The grandfathers of mental health might have been Jung and Freud. I think they probably get most of the credit.
Yes. Yet. I think where you're going is what's the contest between belief and the science of mental health? And I suppose the real touch point for that, somebody who articulated it so well, was Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his understanding that, you know, famously he said the simplest Christian knows more than a psychiatrist knows, because the simplest Christian has a faith in the redemption of Christ. And what that brings for mankind. Now, one wonders whether that kind of dichotomous contest that was relevant in the times of the terrible Nazi regime is relevant now. Modern mental health care actually is synergistic and is a synthesis of people with faith and no faith, of humanity. And in fact, Swift's guidance in terms of a cleric brings us back to the idea which is about the middle way between science and if you like, a dogmatic faith. That via media is really important. One of the historical things about Patrick's is that there's so many memorabilia around there of him, and there are windows with his mottos in them, and Festina Lente, make haste slowly, Cum Magnus Vixisse, I've been with the great. Turns out these are the mottos of Erasmus, great figure of the Renaissance, who also held on to faith and science and found a middle way between them. And so this is something that is actually very Swiftian.
People, when they start to get into an interest in science, they'll start applying the science to everything around them. That would be the training, that would be the general idea. Mm-hmm. And then you may find yourself finding a little bit of contempt for other people who hold a faith by mm-hmm. way of explanation. Mm-hmm. There is a history of that too across medicine. Mm-hmm. You know, at one stage, people might have been possessed, and now we might see it as schizophrenia or some other form of psychosis that happens.
And the words there that really ring out would be, first of all, let's look at contempt. This is completely contrary to any Christian sense, isn't it? I mean, a faith that isn't about respect and kindness isn't worth a damn. But it's also completely contrary to any humanist sense of being of healthcare. And has no place in legitimate science here. You can't actually bring contempt. In fact, you've got to bring humility to these things. And in my world, that's not a difficulty for me, because I'm taught all the time by my patients. We maddeningly call each other service users now, but then, in fact, we're all service users. As far as I'm concerned, we'll all be patients one day. It's part of being human. So that is alien to me and to my colleagues and staff. It would be away from the culture that I'm proud to be part of. But the other sense in which your question raises this idea of respect for others and beyond the sort of scientific view, or indeed beyond the religious view. And I think that faith probably now is something that is more dynamic than that. One hopes that it's something that is in this time, this modern time of information and education, hopefully, and social media even. We're now challenged to have a more dynamic, open sense of what it is to believe.
I'm very conscious of how I'm going to frame this question, but let me have a go. If God didn't exist, would we as human beings need to create him?
I mean, there's a question. I mean, I love the Bob Hope joke about the man around the time of the early moon shots. You know, they went round to the dark side of the moon and they found God and she's just great. So it's a question of our prejudices there. Would we need to create him? I think that we would be searching. I think there's an inner search in us for love. And I think that we would deny a sense of our humanity if we didn't recognize that we had a search for what is good. We hear so much about the calamities, the terrible traumas and the terrible wickednesses that happen in the world. 15-minute news, we'll keep you updated, all the bad news. But actually that belies the real truth that I see, is that people seek recovery. They seek the good. They seek well-being. They seek love. And they instinctively believe that that is there.
I'm thinking of people who might approach their faith in one of two ways. They either approach it in a benign way, which means that it's personal to themselves and they act out their beliefs. And there are others that approach it in a way that is a little bit more fundamental, or a little bit more strident. They seem to be using faith, religion and the rules that go with it to control other people rather than necessarily themselves.
I mean, I think that Pope Francis has put this so well. I mean, we can't mothball faith into a set of rules. But these words, all the words are laden. I mean, you're a man who understands words, Michael. It's important. Fundamental. Do things have a basis? They do. But like any structure, they can't just stay at the basis. They need to grow and expand. And we need to address the challenges of now. It's the dichotomy you put between somebody who perhaps is fundamental and I suspect judgmental with somebody who has a personal and benign faith. Actually, we could reverse those. One could be fundamental and benign, and one could have a personal or indeed an impersonal practice that was alien.
I'm thinking about the fact that for some, an observer might see a faith actually causing more anxiety than it causes comfort and serenity.
Well, one of the critiques of religion, say Dawkins and others who argue that it is a tyranny, point to this truth that you can't point to a particular religion that actually is better for your mental health than others. But one of the things that is clear is that a belief is part of well-being. And for those who strive for well-being, and we all do it every day, holding on to ultimately a belief in good and a belief in the worthwhileness of living itself. I mean, two people die by suicide every day in this country. And it's the biggest cause of loss of life throughout most of life until the 50s. And at its core, there is a despair there. And a despair which is about the loss of belief in the value of oneself. Mm. And to me, in mental health, striving to address that issue, is really a longing that's every day in our work.
I was at a conference recently and the speaker asked everybody in the room to give a show of hands if that morning they'd brushed their teeth. And everybody put up their hands and said they had. And then she said, put up your hands if you've done something for your mental health today. And only two people put up their hands.
Isn't that extraordinary? I mean, I think it is extraordinary that our culture is so impoverished of wellness and of an understanding, which includes the spiritual. But it includes many aspects that are holistic, Dr. Diet, Dr. Quiet and Dr. Merry Man. And that sense in which we don't go there, you know, Heaney's line, whatever you say, say nothing, is part of Ireland as well. We're very frightened of mental health.
It's still a taboo.
But, you know, we talk a lot about stigma and you know, stigma is also ignorant and it's also unkind. And it's ignorant because, in fact, mental health is our issue for all of us. Every one of us, every family in the land has a mental health issue. And people think I'm critical of Irish families for saying that. I'm just reaching out to the truth I know. But also it's unkind in the sense that it alienates those of us who can or would recover if we had just the communication around it.
You're listening to The Leap of Faith here on RTÉ Radio 1. Our guest this evening is Professor Jim Lucey. Can I ask you to expand a little bit more on this idea of us as human beings and our need for certainty? We need to know what happens after death. Mm. We need to know where we came from. Mm. Is this a peculiar human condition? Mm.
I think it goes to our anxiety. It goes to our journey through life. We often talk in mental health about the mental health journey, a narrative. And I think at various times we have greater or lesser need for certainty. I wonder whether in many ways as we grow in faith, whether we have given too much certainty or given the idea that certainty is the ambition. You know, you believe because you have seen, but blessed are those who believe even though they haven't seen. In other words, the uncertainty of faith is really what makes faith blessed.
Many faiths have a principle of it's God's will.
Inshallah, yes. Yeah. The belief is more than just a resignation to fate. I keep going back to this idea that there is ultimately a good in humanity, and ultimately good is a value that we strive whether we're a faith or no faith. Now, some people say they're not striving for good, and good luck to us. And at times we all fail in the sense of our striving for good. But the overwhelming, uplifting experience I have of human beings is that we really are all longing for a good. We don't have a certainty about its existence any more than we have a certainty about the existence of love. But we all long for an assurance that it is there. And the idea that it is there is something that is rebuilt every day when you see recovery in mental health.
And yet in your profession, you will recognise the narcissist, the sociopath and the psychopath.
Yes. The fascination of my work, I suppose, is something, Michael, that includes seeing a full range of human beings. And there are people who will say to you, no, I don't want those things. I want money. I want fame. I want to be regarded. I want status. The narcissistic agenda fits a great deal with much of our material world and with the world of the marketplace. But they're unusual, to be honest with you, Michael. Most people actually are in quiet desperation.
Who is Aaron Beck?
Well, Aaron Beck is, of course, the Philadelphian great father of cognitive behavioural therapy. But I suppose, putting it simply, he was the man who, with his school of thinking, showed that you can learn thoughts and unlearn thoughts, and that in a sense, we needed to reverse our paradigm. Previously, people thought that if you were depressed, it made you think in a depressive way. But supposing it was the reverse, supposing thinking in a depressive way made you depressed, that revolution opened up a whole new avenue for care, because now you could try and learn thinking.
Do we succumb to a negative thought faster than a positive one?
About 9 times faster. It's electric. And the reason for that is because of our humanity and our defensive mechanisms. So Paul Gilbert has extended cognitive behavioural therapy with his famous compassion-focused therapy. And he's pointed out that our mechanisms, our neural mechanisms and our psychological mechanisms are linked in a way which makes fight and flight much more prominent than a leap towards joy or rest. Understandably, you've got to get away from the hazard as a primitive creature far before you can have your needs met in terms of love and warmth.
And is that certainty found then, for some people, in a church building, from a priest, or in a holy book?
I mean, for some people, it can be, obviously. And if the absolute truth, in a sense, of a book or a direction is a structure. Is a fundament that people value. And I suppose in terms of the rigor of that, there's a certain certainty, a kind of reassurance. But of course, no fundament can stand unless it's enhanced by further developments and responds to further changes. It'll die. And those changes, I suppose, were guided by the Holy Spirit for a Christian who believes in that working in the world.
I'm fascinated by how people and organisations now talk about resilience like it's a new faith.
Yes.
And that in some way that we have to be these amazingly resilient individuals. Mm. But sometimes the stronger the person, the more likely they are to snap or break.
Well, one of the problems, Michael, with these words is that they it's particularly the ones with a good idea behind them. They catch on awfully quickly, but an understanding of them becomes quite shallow. I remember Michael Rutter being in the corner of the library where I trained in London in the Institute of Psychiatry, a great giant of a man, quietly spoken, never really pushed himself forward. He was the leading figure of mental health in childhood in Britain. And he had discovered the idea of resilience in many ways from his own wartime experience, having been deported transported as a child away from the Blitzkrieg. And he saw that the children on the transporter, he was going across America to America, some of them were upset and some of them weren't. But they were all separated from mother. They were all traumatized. And he asked himself, well, was the prevailing view that maternal separation, that Bowlby's view, and indeed the early years, that Freudian view, was that the determining factor for resilience? And he discovered that no. Actually, the determining factors include many complex things like the security of our base, like our education, like our positive values and whether we have them, like the ability to have friendships, talents and interests, and the kind of engagement with each other that comes from that shared experience.
And yet there might even be an argument that that's what some people will get by being brought up in a faith.
But of course it is. But of course that's the case. And of course, a non-faith education that actually has those values could deliver those. Whether it will deliver those is a matter for experience. But the truth of it is that those fundamentals, and Rutter was a non-theist Quaker, expanded the notion of resilience and allowed us avenues into human recovery that in mental health and indeed the church and churches can all pursue. But what they didn't do was make resilience into a word that you beat people up with. Sorry, you're not mentally well, you're not spiritually well, because you're not resilient enough.
You need to be more resilient.
You need to be more resilient. Yes, you need to be more resilient to work here, exactly. And the idea is that ultimately these words become unkind. But if you unpack them, you discover that there's a human truth that's true for the theists and the non-theists.
There are a number of people, and we've been doing this program now for about 3 years, and in talking to them, who are still holding a great deal of hurt about the faith in which they were born into and that they were brought up in. As a psychiatrist, is there a model, a structure, a vision that you can give to a person about what the ultimate outcome is with that anger?
When as a psychiatrist, I can say that the recognition of the pain of people, either in at the hands of religionists or indeed at the hands of secularists, is unavoidable, and in fact it's important to acknowledge that. That's I think why it's important to have the faith conversation, or the spiritual conversation, or the belief conversation as part of the mental health assessment. There are people, for example, who say this should never be part of your agenda. What it can't be for a psychiatrist is part of my agenda. But it must be open to people to open their agenda as fully as possible into faith or non-faith, into belief or non-belief, into hope or despair.
Do you ever get a sense of despair or anger? I'm using two negative emotions here as the challenge to you about the state of mental health and how we're approaching it.
I think if Aaron Beck is right, it should be about 9 times more than I get the hopeful ones, isn't it? We attach to these despairing and angry feelings. There's a zeal that comes from your determination and your recognition of how impoverished our mental health services are. And we've dismantled the asylums, but we haven't rebuilt community care. We've talked a lot about mental health being a value, but we don't put it in the budget. Every day I ask myself why it isn't in the agenda of our schools to teach mindfulness and to try and help resilience.
Would mindfulness help?
Mindfulness would be a skill that people would actually value. And the beauty of it is that you can do that whether you're a secularist or whether you're a religionist. It's actually a human skill to be able to be at rest and to clear the mind and to live in what Kabat-Zinn calls full catastrophic reality. That is the exposure which, in many ways, probably the anxious generation we're in is lacking, because while we're constantly bombarded with anxiety, we're also constantly told that we need to go and be safe. And that dichotomy means we feel we can't be safe because we can't get away from the hazards at any stage, and we can't face the hazards because they're too catastrophic. So we need to rebalance our sense of experiencing the world with its hazards.
What would you like to happen in the next period of time that you have tenure where you are? What would be your measure of your own success?
Michael, my success is not important. And indeed, 270 years of mental health in St. Patrick's teaches you that. I've just hold briefly onto the legacy there for while I have it. But I would love to think that mental health would expand in a human rights framework. That would be the fundamental of it. And I would hope that it would do so in an evidence-based way in which it balanced a recognition of humanity and their human rights with a recognition of the science and the need for meaningful treatment. So that means having that broader sense of a scientific and humane from my point of view, a Christian humanist point of view, but from the point of view of the service, one that is actually open to the new reality, the data of the brain. And the fact is we now have windows onto how we work, how our bodies work, how our minds work. Even this week, the new Nobel Prize winning award goes to the people who've understood how time affects our bodies. The clock genes have been discovered. Fantastic new reality. We now know what we've known for so long, that sleep is essential for recovery. And now we know the biology of that. So we're not going to stop insight by saying we have a faith or a non-faith. What we have to say is we don't know, and we actually do share a belief in the good.
Where do you rate loneliness as a problem?
It's a huge factor. And I suppose isolation has been one of the contributors to the material decline in mental health that we've seen. So people are more atomized, more separated, more individual. There's more meals for one, or indeed not cooking a meal, than there was before in our lives. So that on the one hand, while individualism gives a great avenue for many people and a liberation from a society that probably was tied down into wider structures of family and neighbourhood and community, on the other hand, a loss of individualism is also a huge challenge.
You mentioned earlier in the interview that you keep a clear distinction between any influence that your faith would bring to your professional teaching and the methods and the data that you work to. Yet you're a professor and you also train other psychiatrists. What influence do you bring to them that would be, that someone could say, well, I studied under Professor Jim Lucy and here's what he taught me?
Well, I suppose I would hope that this clinical approach, which is fundamentally based on kindness and respect for human rights, for the humanity, some fun. I don't want to be a dry old stick. And the reality is mental health is tremendously rewarding in terms of the humanity and also the joy of people. So I don't really want to be remembered as somebody who gave a boring lecture ever. I think that would be the worst, wouldn't it?
Professor Jim Lucy, thank you for joining us on The Leap of Faith.